They examine topics like the dangers of low lead levels in the blood or the data opportunities in shale and oil and gas. They're members of the Association of Environmental and Resource Economists, and for the first time, this group of mostly academics has named a government practitioner as a fellow. Al McGartland is director of the EPA's National Center for Environmental Economics, and he joins me now. Dr. McGartland, good to have you on.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with your office, the National Center for Environmental Economics. Where does it fit in the pantheon of EPA, and what does it do?
So EPA is a very complicated bureaucracy, right? That we implement many statutes, many laws. So there's a Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Superfund, RCRA laws on governing waste, on laws on chemicals, a new TSCA bill, et cetera. All those, implementing all those statutes require regulations, and those regulations in turn need regulatory analysis, economic analysis to support the decision-making and the rulemaking process. And so dating back to President Ronald Reagan's Executive Order 12866, every president since then has had an executive order requiring benefit cost analysis of all economically significant regulations. And so that those executive orders have morphed a little bit over time, but essentially they're the same. And it's the National Center for Environmental Economics job to work with all the program offices to complete these economic analysis, make sure that it's sort of top science, top economics, and can inform both decision-making and inform the public, frankly, about what our costs are and what the benefits are of various regulatory options.
So you work across the various domains, water, air, and so on.
That's correct. In fact, I often joke that although there are economists in the air office, there are economists in the water office, et cetera, the research or the analytic umbrella that they enjoy, they get a deep dive into water, but I much prefer the broad breadth of working across all of the environmental programs.
Did you come up through a specialty of your own?
I did. I actually started on some, and back, I did my dissertation at the University of Maryland, and I was fortunate enough under Dr. Wally Oates to do a dissertation on emissions trading and setting sort of a prices for pollution, which now is commonplace. But back then, in the 1980s, you know, most environmentalists were opposed to that idea. In fact, most environmental professionals were unfamiliar with the concept. So it was very challenging to take that kind of literature. I was able to spin it into a number of journal articles and things as well. But now with the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, which I got to work on, the implementing regulations for those, that actually for the first time set up a trading scheme for SO2 out of electric utilities. And that's proven with over time to be a tremendous success. And the idea now of pricing pollution either through taxes or marketable permits is a well-grounded and well-accepted notion for environmental policy.
So pricing is also an innovation, as was cost-benefit analysis, I guess, when it first got started.
Well, that's right. When I first joined EPA and Ronald Reagan issued his executive order, there was sort of like a dearth of studies. We didn't even know how to define the commodity of environmental quality. You know, what did people really care about? What were their benefits were, and how much were they willing to pay to protect themselves and the costs, et cetera. So the capturing those benefits of improved environmental quality back in the 80s with very little studies to transfer into the agency was a real challenge.
And to put it in terms, I mean, the thinking is that if you would spend $1 trillion to save one life, probably not worth it. But to spend $1 to save a million lives, no doubt about it. And somewhere we have to pick on that continuum what we do.
That's right. So either we can be explicit about those choices or implicit, right? So once you make a policy decision that doesn't go to absolute pristine air, which would cost a astronomical amount of money and may not even be technologically feasible, we're making a choice, right? And so this analysis makes it more transparent what those choices are.
A lot of the calculations that come out sound like that, calculations based on what it would cost this plant and how many parts per million. But that's calculating. That's not really the same as economics. Tell us how economics builds on calculations or informs it.
So economics is all about trade-offs, right? And so we are, in the case you just mentioned, we're trading off costs, environmental pollution abatement costs, for example, over these increased benefits. And so typically we have an array of benefits, or it might be reduced cancers or lower lead exposures has an array of things, so including IQ and other neurotoxic things in kids, and all the way up to hypertension benefits in adults. So the idea is to try to get all these health effects and the changes in small probability of risk of catching these health effects through pollution to a common denominator that we can compare to cost, and that common denominator, of course, is dollars. And so we look at what society is willing to pay to reduce these risks in their own lives. And so when you go out the door or when you make purchases, you make choices all the time that trade off risks and benefits. So when you put your kids on a school bus, we want certain safety things in there, but of course they're not completely safe, but you trade off those risks in your lives. Or workers that work on a skyscraper get a higher wage rate for in exchange for working on a more dangerous job. So there's those kind of trade-offs inherent. We buy smoke detectors. Some of us like Volvos because they're safe. Some of us like to drive motorcycles and they're not safe. But so we all have a certain preferences for safety. And then there's water quality benefits, recreational benefits from improved water quality. And so we, as environmental economists, think about all of those, whether it be commercial fishing or recreational fishing or swimming in cleaner waters, et cetera. All that matters in some sense in the environment, and we try to put a price tag on that. And that the paradigm for that is what people are willing to pay. So it's almost like a consumer sovereignty principle. We don't make those numbers up. We actually try to assess what people in society are willing to pay for those benefits.
We're speaking with Al McCartland. He's director of the EPA's National Center for Environmental Economics. And let's get to the Association of Environmental and Resource Economists, which has inducted you as a fellow, which is a great honor. And you're the first government person, and this is a worldwide organization. Tell us what you do with them, what your association is, and how it got to their attention.
I am still flabbergasted and just thrilled to have that award. It was awarded late last week, but at their annual meetings, which actually this year were in Pittsburgh, but rotate.
A city that's really cleaned up its act.
Indeed it has. So maybe that's fitting as well. But ARE, or the Association of Environmental and Resource Economists, is worldwide, and most of its members are mainly academics and research organizations. But it was started as a way to come together to sort of build a profession. When I got my PhD in 1984 from the University of Maryland, environmental economics wasn't even a field of economics. And so this fledgling kind of area of economics had to first become a field. And when it did, the way to sort of mark that was to sort of create this professional organization so other environmental economists could come together. Now, almost every major university has one or two or more environmental economists teaching environmental economics, both on the undergraduate level and graduate levels, and doing a lot of research. That research, by the way, is, I joked to all my fellow economists at ARE that they're the wholesale operation, right? They give me the studies that inform regulations, and I apply those studies, whether it be benefit studies or cost studies or employment or macroeconomic impact studies, whatever. But I use those studies to inform on a regulation.
So you attend their meetings and know who they are. So it's kind of like colleagues have really recognized you in this fashion.
That's exactly right. So,
and in the citation, they note that as many of them have gone on to economics and in some cases industrial careers, you did public service. And I think that seemed to impress them.
I think that's right. I mean, I got addicted, frankly, to the EPA and the policy, but it can be a kind of exciting high almost to bring all this information to bear about a big decision, right, that has implications for society and for Americans. So the idea that I'm honored to bring all this information to decision makers and to the public and to the White House and the Congress, et cetera, is just exciting, and it's never stopped being exciting from when I started.
Now, ultimately, the EPA is run by politicians, and you've worked for them from all sides here. How do you make sure that whatever side they're on stays out of the real analysis and economic honesty that you try to bring to this with the group that you're in charge of?
We're pretty good about that. It's never comes up as a big issue. I think because economics is a science, EPA treats it as a science. We have a environmental economics advisory committee from our science advisory board. We are all active in the profession, et cetera. We try to publish. So there are certain things that are just economics and that's our purview. There are policy decisions which appropriately belong for policy officials. The other thing I'll say is that a benefit cost analysis does not make the policy decision for the administrator or the decision official. It's one input among many. So the statute often directs them. Sometimes they're not even allowed to look at costs when they make a decision. So although that's rare, but it does happen. So it's just one input. So they don't need to be afraid of it in that sense. It's just who wouldn't want to know what the benefits and costs are before they make a big decision.
From the ARI group, did you get a wall plaque or a piece of sculpture?
It was a wall plaque, yeah.
All right. Dr. Alma Gartland is director of EPA's National Center for Environmental Economics. Congratulations and thanks for joining me.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Find a link to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.